Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of Divorce Conversations for Women. I'm your host, Rhonda Nordeich. I'm so glad that you're here. We are going to deeper dive to help women ask the right questions so they get the right answers. And so I have the privilege of interviewing Lisa Zeiderman today, and she is a managing partner for one of the largest firms in New York, right? And so I'm so glad that you are here to join us today.
Thanks so much. I'm very excited to be here with you.
So let's go ahead and dive in. I have a question that I would love your input on, and that is, I know that you work with men and women, but for the women that are listening, if you could tell them one thing, one word of advice from your perspective, what would you tell them?
So I think for many women, being able to stay the course is going to be the most important piece of this. I think women tend to give up or get worn down. They are dealing with their children, their careers, trying to figure out the divorce, worried about their futures. And I think for many of them, they just get worn down. And so they need to stay the course and they need to make sure that essentially what they need to do, identifying assets, figuring out the custody situation that is best for their children, making sure that they have proper support, all of those things, and not rush to the end just to get it done with and be out.
That's interesting. I'm so glad that you said that, because when I think about the divorce process, right, I think of a marathon. And I used to run, I do not run anymore. But I mean, 26.1 miles, right, is a long way. And if you don't have the proper training and you don't have the proper support and the proper rest and nutrition and all of those kinds of things, right, lay of the land, it is going to be, I mean, you're going to want to quit. No doubt about it. So I think that analogy really sums up this process, right? And I think women do get overwhelmed and just want it to be over.
They do. And they also have to understand that it's a bit of a roller coaster. There's going to be days that it's all going to go wonderfully, right? It's all going to go great. And then there are going to be days that it's going to be disappointing or frustrating. And to your point, it's a marathon, not a sprint. And so they need to just understand that they're looking at the longer run and they are looking to make sure that they get to the end in a way that works for them and for their kids.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And obviously, self-care is a really important piece, you know, of that component. I was talking to a woman the other day and she was like, well, sometimes you just want to eat burgers and fries. And I'm like, well, you can do that sometimes. But like, if that's like every day, right? And you got to show up as the best you possible to get through this marathon, right? Like, is that maybe the best thing for fuel?
Exactly. That's exactly right. We tell people that they have to take care of themselves, to your point. Many times we say to a client, you need to see a therapist or you should see a therapist. You might want to get a career counselor. Utilizing services of other professionals besides your lawyer is also important so that you have a more collaborative process and you're taking care of all of the issues in your life. And you need that support system very often during a divorce because it's not an easy process. It's really the most stressful time for people. They're trying to resolve issues regarding finances and children. And both of those, not necessarily in that order, are really the most important issues in their lives.
Yeah. One of the things I was thinking about too, kind of along that line, is I'm seeing a lot more from a marketing standpoint. And I say that marketing because it's really important. From a marketing standpoint of click here to have an amicable divorce. And I was like, I would love your input on that because I have very strong feelings about that word.
So it takes two to have an amicable divorce. And everyone comes to me, or most people come to me and they say they want to have an amicable divorce. And of course, everybody wants to have an amicable divorce. Why wouldn't you want to have an amicable divorce, right? But the problem is that in order to have that amicable divorce, you're giving up, frankly, too much. Amicable is important because sometimes you have issues where you're going to be co-parenting in the future, but that doesn't mean that you also want to be a doormat. There's a difference between being amicable and being a doormat. And you need to make sure that you are standing up and advocating for yourself and advocating for your children's interests and making sure that you are protected because this is going to be a lasting agreement that you're going to be entering into and or a lasting situation.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that's what's interesting, right? Because if we really look at the definition of that word, it is without large disagreements. And I'm like, oh, so we're going to handle all of these things without disagreements? To your point, right? That means somebody's going to back down and say, yeah, whatever you want. No, no, on either side of it. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, it's really important that people come to the table and say, hey, listen, we're not going to agree on everything, but is there a way that we can navigate through this in a respectful way and give and take a little bit, right? There is a quid pro quo kind of aspect to say, well, if that's really important to you and this is really important to me, how can we navigate through that?
That's exactly right. And once you've made those decisions, then there's a negotiation that can take place.
Isn't that interesting, right? When we actually take a little bit of the emotion out of it and we look at the logic, it like makes no sense.
Exactly. That's why you're here, is because you couldn't resolve a lot of your differences. So while you are going to be mom and dad forever, okay, and that's true, you also need to look at the fact that perhaps you don't have the earning capacity that you might have had if you were in the workforce continuously, that you might not have the ability to have the lifestyle that you had unless you negotiate something, frankly, that is going to be in your favor.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And I think the negotiation piece is an important piece of that, right? Because we have to, again, start with those priorities and what's important, and then have the right people that can help us negotiate.
Exactly.
So I know you wrote an article in Psychology Today, and you've written several of them, but the one that I know you highlighted here was one that talks about the financial empowerment and tax issues related to child custody. So I know that the official title, which I'll read, is really important. Legal Matters, Understanding Mental Health Issues as They Apply to Divorce and Child Custody. Talk to us a little bit about that.
So I think that one of the issues that people first should understand when, and I've written a lot about this subject, when they're going through child custody disputes, what you say to your therapist is not necessarily private, because you are putting your mental health at issue and when you are in a custody dispute. And so you should understand that your therapy records will be utilized perhaps in custody disputes. So that's certainly one issue that people I think are not aware of and should be aware of. So while we definitely want people to go to therapists and get the help that they can, they should understand that some of the things that they say may not be as private as they wish they could be, and things that they said in the past. The other thing that I think people need to understand is that if they do have a mental health condition, that does not mean that they can't be a great parent or have custody. That means that they need to be compliant with medications, therapy, making sure that they are extremely transparent so that the other parent knows what is going on and that they can parent together. And we have a lot of people who have mental health issues, and nonetheless, they are great parents, and they are great parents because they have learned to deal with their mental health issues. And in some place times, they are the better parent of the two, frankly. And when I say that, they have really done a deep dive into some of their mental health issues so that they can recognize and develop strategies of how to deal better with their children and with their other parent.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's an important topic, because I think a lot of times people want to use that, right? Or pin it against the other person. I love the compliant piece of it because, yeah, there are going to be some things that need to be put into place to make sure that the kids are in a safe space, but also giving them that opportunity to really step into that as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, people come to me and they say, well, I need to go to a psychiatrist, and my therapist recommended that I, you know, maybe see a psychiatrist to take anti-anxiety medication, but I don't think that I should be taking the anti-anxiety medication because that'll just ruin my chances for custody. Well, what will ruin your chances for custody is if you don't take the anti-anxiety medication, and you should be, and you are not able to cope with the divorce, with your children, with co-parenting. That's what will be, unfortunately, the ruination, essentially, of your custody. So many people are able to cope very, very well with mental health issues.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, let's tie that into the financial aspect, because as much as child custody and placement and finances seem like they're two separate things, they're actually pretty interrelated. So let's transition just a little bit and now talk a little around the financial aspect.
One of the things that I'm going to say that I see a lot in my practice is an issue of control about finances. And I think to some degree that goes to mental health issues, but it also goes to custody, and it also obviously affects financial. We see a lot of people, and frankly, it's not gender specific. We see people who come into our office who really do not have any idea what their finances are. And when I say that, they have no idea what accounts there are, no idea what investments have been made, haven't really even looked at the tax return that maybe they've been signing and was put in front of them year after year, and were maybe even told that they didn't need to look at it, or that they wouldn't understand it anyway, or that it wasn't any of their business, or that it wasn't their money, which is, we hear that a lot, right? The other person earned the income and therefore it's not something that they need to worry about or be concerned about, that there'll always be plenty, right? That's the other line. And of course, there won't necessarily always be plenty, and one needs to really know what the asset structure is and not to be essentially blind to what's going on, because marriage is a financial partnership. And I think people don't realize actually that marriage is a financial partnership and that they need to understand their finances, that they have to be in control as well, and that they need to be able to identify the assets. And so even during the first consultation that I have with people, I ask them to identify what assets do they have, what assets in the other spouse's name, where are these assets located, what investments have been made, do you have a marital residence, is there a mortgage, has it been refied, what is the situation in terms of 401k plans, IRAs, pensions, and of course, other investment accounts that they may have, or cash surrender value of life insurance. And many people are frankly in the dark about this. They don't necessarily know. So then we say to them, well, maybe if you bring in a tax return, or like the last 3 years of tax returns would be helpful. So that's something that when they come to a consultation, if they bring that, then we can start to look through some of the schedules on the tax return, the Schedule B, the Schedule C, the Schedule E, right? Which will give us some information about assets, because there'll be dividends, perhaps an interest on a Schedule B, or there'll be maybe a spouse is in a business. And so there may be a Schedule C, which lays out the business income and or the expenses. And then the Schedule E, if there's rental property, for example, that will turn up on a Schedule E perhaps. So the tax return is, it's a basic document. I'm always surprised how many people don't have it, unfortunately, in their possession or in their control. Accountants are required to give it to both the parties. So that usually is the first thing that we try to ask for.
Yeah. And I think that's really great information, right? Because a lot of times if people are working with an accountant, there is some hesitation to say, well, can they give it to me or whatever? And the reality of it is you just have to ask for it in order to be able to get that. So it's an important step and it does provide a lot of information, right?
Exactly. And then we work with a lot of people who are in the financial world or in the banking world. And then there are things to keep in mind about restricted stock units and restricted stock shares and the complications that arise from that. One of the things I will say is I am a certified divorce financial analyst also, in addition to being a matrimonial attorney. And that has served me very well because I am able to spot many of the issues in terms of finances. And I'm not an accountant and I'm not a tax attorney, but I know many times if I see a tax issue, and one of the issues, and I'm sure you encounter this, is whether or not to keep the marital residence, for example. And with the marital residence comes a capital gains tax, perhaps, or transfer taxes and broker's fees. So that is something that people have to think about when they're keeping the marital residence, whether they would have been better off selling it or not. Now, you ask me, how does that relate to custody? Well, if you're the primary caretaker for your children, you might be more apt to want to keep the marital residence because you want to keep your children in the marital residence and it offers stability for the children. On the other hand, it may not be financially sound to do that because you may be paying for capital gains taxes or other taxes later or broker's fees that perhaps you could be dividing now during your divorce instead of paying that on your own later and maybe finding another house or another apartment that you could live in with your children in the same area.
Yeah. And I think what's interesting about that too is, can they even keep the marital residence from a financial perspective, right? Like there's been a couple times where, and you can fill me in as far as how it is in New York, because I know each state's a little bit different, but there is typically a seasoning process in which that we need to be able to show that there's some income coming in to the household from alimony, maintenance, or child support for it to count toward the mortgage. And I've had some clients where the attorneys have said, well, we'll deal with that later. I'm like, no, we can't deal with it later though. We need to turn on that temporary support now so that we can start the clock so that if you want to refi the house, we have an idea of what that looks like.
That's 100% correct. And sometimes they need 6 months of alimony that has been paid before they can actually apply. So one of the things that one has to look at as an attorney in drafting the agreement is making sure that if there's going to be a refinance that occurs or someone is going to be removed from a mortgage, that there be enough time so that if you haven't actually had that temporary support, that there be enough time to have that support in place in a permanent agreement so that they can go to get a refinancing or remove somebody from the mortgage. But there has to be enough income or there has to be enough equity in the house. And many people don't know how much equity is in their house because they don't know how much the balance of their mortgage is. And perhaps one person was really in charge or in control of doing these refinances. And then the question also is, where did that money go if money was taken out? So this is an endless stream of questions, but these are the kinds of questions that have to be answered. And so I'll circle back to what I said at the beginning, which is you have to stay the course because that information takes time to actually gather. And sometimes you have a reluctant spouse who is not very interested in having you gather that information. And so you need to have attorneys who actually will push for that information and help you actually gain that information.
Well, and it's interesting because as I was prepping for our time together, I know that you work a lot with high income couples, right? And I think the more often than not in those situations, what I'm seeing as the CDFA as well, but I'm solo CDFA, right, is coming in and saying, okay, well, somebody comes to the table with an offer without ever even disclosing the information.
Yes, I see that many, many times. And I spend a lot of time counseling clients about the fact that they really should get the information. Now, look, there are clients who will say to me, this is enough for me and I'm happy with the offer and I'll take it. And you know what? That's fine. But I have also had the experience where people basically regret that they've done that, right? Because they did not decide to get all the information. And then they realize that what they received was really not that fair because they see their spouse driving the Porsche or they see their spouse going to the clubs and they can no longer afford to do that. And they can't figure out, well, how could my ex-spouse afford to do that when that person said that they had no money? And that all the money was gone and that we had spent it. The other piece of it is that in going through the record, sometimes we find that there's a dissipation of marital assets. I don't know if you have that issue in your practice, but sometimes we see through either extramarital affairs or drug use, substance abuse use, or even gambling, okay, that there has been a dissipation of assets and that those monies need to actually be counted essentially and accounted for when we're dividing up the marital estate.
Yes. Yeah, very much so. And you know what? I think at the end of the day, right, I think it comes back down to having all the information to make a good decision, right? Because like, yeah, they can say, well, that'll be enough. Well, okay. But like, what's that look like in a few years from now, right? And when you find out that there was really money there, yeah, there's going to be a lot of regret and bitterness and whatever. And it's like, if everybody could just come to the table in full transparency on what they have and where it is, our lives would be a lot easier, as would theirs.
But when someone hands a list, essentially, with no backup and says, I'm just going to give you blank, okay,
that's right.
That is already a recipe for a problem in my mind. That is no backup, no documentation. And by the way, let's mediate this, okay? Because you don't need to have really an attorney. The attorney can just review it at the end. Let's just go mediate this. And there you are with a mediator. And one person has all the information and the other person has no information and is expected in this mediation to be advocating for himself or herself. And that's an impossibility when you don't have the information. How do you advocate?
That's right. And then you have the mediator who is a neutral third party who can't actually, I mean, their commitment is to the process, not to the people. And so you have two people, right? And then you have the person whose love language is spreadsheets and they come in and they like try to dominate the conversation and there's spreadsheets everywhere. And then you have the other person who's feeling intimidated so they don't ask any questions. I mean, it is. It's just like, it frustrates me to no end.
It's a recipe for a disaster. And it's also a recipe for making sure that someone does not get their equitable share. And in New York, we have equitable distribution, not equal distribution. But again, we need to know what there is. And the other piece of it is that through discovery, sometimes we find out that we're not dividing necessarily apples to apples when somebody actually figured all of this out, right? So dividing those apples is really important in making sure that you're not getting essentially rotten apples, right?
Yeah.
Because there are Roth IRAs and there are IRAs, right? Roth IRAs, which were you've already paid the taxes on, and IRAs that you haven't paid the taxes on, and there could be early penalties, although during COVID, we're not seeing that right now through the CARES Act, but it has to be analyzed.
Right. And that's going to be temporary, right? Like the CARES Act, it's going to go away at some point.
That's right. And people have to have an analysis, and sometimes working with an attorney and a financial planner or a certified divorce financial analyst is so important so that you make sure you are actually dividing the apples to the apples, the good apples.
Love that. I love that analogy, right? Because you bite into it, you're like, what the? Gross. This wasn't at all what I thought it was going to be, right?
Right, exactly. And making sure that you're watching for tax consequences. When I was thinking about today and financial issues, I was thinking, I think the biggest financial area to essentially the pitfalls are with tax issues because people just don't consider the tax issues. And although maintenance, alimony, spousal support is no longer taxable or tax deductible, there are still tax issues to watch for because you're transferring assets. Yes, that's not taxable, but there may be tax consequences to the assets that you're transferring, capital gains taxes for investment brokerage accounts when you go to actually sell the stock that you've purchased, right? There could be huge tax consequences in some cases. And so you want to make sure.
Well, and it's interesting because I was talking to somebody the other day and she said, oh yeah, well, my husband wants to take all of the deductions for the kids, right? And I'm like, yeah, but he's going to phase out. So if your youngest kid is 3 years old and you've got 15 years worth of support in some form or fashion for the child support, and he has only upside potential, at some point he's going to phase out and then you're not going to have the ability to do that. And she was like, oh yeah. I'm like, no, we got to take a deeper dive at this. Like, pause.
Exactly. And again, I think that that phasing out, making sure that in your agreement, there is something that actually provides for the other person to receive the tax benefit. If one spouse cannot take that tax benefit in the future, that's really important. People don't really understand sometimes that there is going to be a phase out. I mean, there's so many ways to craft an agreement that actually provides for these tax issues. Some people don't know, for example, that 529 accounts under the Trump law that was put into effect actually allows you to pay for private school education in some cases. A portion, it's I think $10,000 for each child or each year that you can use that monies. That might actually be important for someone, particularly someone who might have a child who has learning differences and needs to go to a special school. There are many, many issues to deal with. And so doing this in a rush and doing this without information, I'm just going to say it's a bad idea. It's just a bad idea.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, and all the details, right, that go into it. I mean, there's just all the little nuances that can really come back to bite people later. Now, in New York, particularly, once somebody signs the final agreement, how long do they have to wait until they could make any changes to it?
Well, so for equitable distributions, there's no changes. And for child support, there is, you can change upon a substantial change in circumstances, or if you haven't opted out, you can go back and take a look in 3 years at what everybody's income is, or if there's been a 15% change in income. But sometimes you're not going to know if there's been that 15% change in income. So remember that Porsche that I was talking about earlier, you know, all of a sudden the sports cars are coming and the fancy vacations, and maybe you weren't going to, your spouse wasn't taking the children before to Aspen or to Europe, and all of a sudden those are now the trips. Well, maybe it might be time to take a look at the tax returns and putting in a provision to allow you to do that also, or to exchange tax returns, makes that somewhat easier. But somebody has to think about that. And somebody has to decide, am I getting sufficient or enough support that I actually don't want to take a look at the tax returns, that I'll just deal with on a substantial change in circumstances. If something really significant happens, then we'll go back and look. For maintenance is usually not something that is going to be changed unless there's really something substantial that goes on. And in terms of, as I said, equitable distribution, it's done. It's final. That's it.
Yep. And I think that's an important message because it's making sure that that stuff is buttoned up prior to the signature, doing the due diligence, right, from a legal and financial component, right? That's really, really important. So my role as a CDFA is looking at those marital settlement agreements and just saying, hey, what about this? Or can we have this worded just a little bit differently so it's more clear? Or can we talk about how the variable expenses are going to get paid? Like revisiting all of those things so that by the time they sign it, it's like, hey, listen, you're signing, the property division is done. It's the same in pretty much every state. Once the property division is done, there's no going back. It's the child support, the alimony or maintenance piece that sometimes can be revisited, but there's a waiting period. So it's like, gosh, 2 years is a long time if this was a bad deal.
That's correct. And sometimes, by the way, if it's a bad deal, it's not as if you can just revisit it. There has to be, you know, there has to be an income change. If you made a bad deal in the first instance and everybody's income stays basically the same, you're not getting a change. So again, a bad deal could be a lasting deal. And for so many people who have been out of the workforce, particularly we see women who have been out of the workforce for a long time, this deal might be, frankly, the most important deal that they make in their lives. Because if they haven't been in the workforce for a long time, they may not actually be able to ever get up to a speed in a way that actually is reflective of their earning capacity, because they have been out of the workforce and given up all of those years that has helped their husbands maybe move up the ladder. And so it is really important to make sure that you think of that. And I always say to somebody, well, you say to me, extra 500,000 or that extra 100,000 or that extra 50,000, okay, isn't important. Let's just say that. But how long will it take you to earn that? This is your job for like the next year. This is your job. Your job is to make sure that you actually engage in your divorce. And people should think of it that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, absolutely. And I think that goes back to obviously staying the course piece, which is super important. But for women to be able to ask those questions and come to the table, right, with knowing what they need to be doing. I mean, they have given up oftentimes, right, a lot in order to be able to stay home or to work part-time or whatever. And I think earning capacity is a big deal, even if they technically could make that, right, at this stage in the game, after all these years, you know, what's that actually going to look like? Because there's a ramp-up period.
That's exactly right. There is a ramp-up period. And even with a ramp-up period, I mean, it's difficult to regain that momentum. It is very difficult for people, I think, to regain the momentum that they may have lost by being out of the workforce. And I will say, the law is not that kind to women anymore who have been out of the workforce. I mean, I think that women are expected, and people generally are expected, to ramp up fairly quickly. Now, I don't know what that's going to be like after the pandemic, right? Because there are so many people who are unemployed and finding work might be more difficult. But prior to the pandemic, we were probably at the lowest unemployment rate ever. And because of that, people were expected to be able to go out and get positions and get employment quickly. Certainly, the pandemic is going to have an effect on that.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I think, again, being able to ask the right questions so you get the right answers so you can make good decisions that will put you in a good position moving forward. Again, I think it just stems back to what you said originally, which was, man, just stay the course, right? I mean, make sure you've got all the information. And one of the things I feel like I say on every podcast, because it's so important, is women make really good decisions when they have all of the information. They're very intuitive. They're smart, right? Even if they haven't handled finances, they can, with the right information, will make really good decisions. The problem is when they're not asking or getting all the info.
And that's what they need to use their attorney for. And then once they have that confidence, they need to actually, as I said, stay the course with the attorney, make sure the attorney is watching their back, make sure that the attorney is getting them the information. And they should start looking at the information, by the way. Unfortunately, sometimes fundamentally, they just avoid the information because it's been so long since they actually were ever engaged with it and it feels overwhelming. But this may be an opportunity to actually start to become engaged with your finances.
Absolutely. And I always say we, for the women that we're working with, right, are taking those micro moments to say, hey, let's just take a moment here. Do you know what this is? Well, no, or kind of, or sort of. Okay, well, let's just take just a couple minutes. I want to share with you what you have. Oh, okay, that makes sense, right? And life insurance is always one of those ones that is always kind of interesting, right? Because you're like, yeah, there's like over 500 different types of insurance. So don't feel like you have to know all the answers, right? Like, let's just get enough so you have a basic feel of what's going on. And then, hey, if it's a term that now they're like, oh, next time I hear that, I might not be able to verbatim tell what the term is, the definition, but I've heard that before. Okay. And it's, again, it's just this process of building their confidence as they go through this process as well. So I agree. I mean, this is a great opportunity for women to take, I don't know if interest is the right word, but initiative and being open to learning.
I think just to becoming more familiar with, and because now you're going to be running your own finances. So becoming more familiar with them than you were and understanding what they are and what they mean, I think is really important. Look, they don't have to become accountants, but also understanding that if they are actually going to be running their finances and they don't feel confident to do that, maybe engaging a financial planner to help them with that might be important to do. And someone who can actually really work with them and help guide them through investment strategies, et cetera. That's certainly another piece of this. And we often introduce people to financial planners for just that reason, so that they can have some person who will advise them and be able to guide them through so that they can make proper and, I would say, learned decisions about what they're doing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, I know that we have covered a lot of ground in a really short period of time, but I want to end our time together. If you have a client like success story that really stands out that you'd like to share, I would love to give you a moment to share that.
So I would say we have just finished actually a case now where we were able to uncover $10 million of assets. And we had a client who really had breadcrumbs, literally breadcrumbs. And she would find breadcrumbs and she would bring us the breadcrumbs and we would find the assets. And she is now off in her new life, actually. And she has hired her financial planner and she has her therapist and she has done really well. So I would say probably that is a success story. We also have clients who we have represented that have had mental health issues who have become the custodial parents for their children. So we really work with our clients very closely to try to strategize and to obtain a resolution that works for them.
I love that. I think that's one thing that I see as I'm working with attorneys across the country or get introduced to them is sometimes the lack of strategy, right? I think it's so reactive and they spend a lot of their time putting out fires that you're like, okay, well, where are we going? Like, can we just put together, I mean, and not that you necessarily know totally how things are going to unfold, but like just the next couple steps would be good.
Exactly. And while we work with high net worth people, we also work with people who certainly have lesser assets. And for those people, it's even more critical to make sure that we've identified those assets because those are the assets that they're going to have for their retirement. And those cases are so much more significant in some ways for those people because they don't have as much. And missing $50,000 or $100,000 or $200,000 that has just mysteriously disappeared or can't be identified, that's important.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I think that's really important. Well, I just want to thank you so much for your time today. It was just absolutely lovely getting to hear a little more about what you're doing and get your insight on helping women navigate through this process.
Well, it was really a lot of fun and I loved chatting with you and I hope to see you soon and speak again.
Awesome. Thank you. Well, I just want to thank everybody for tuning in for this episode of Divorce Conversations for Women. I'm your host, Rhonda Nordyke. Don't forget to check out the show notes for information on finding Lisa and all the great things that her firm is doing. And don't forget to follow us on iTunes, like, share, comment. We would love to be able to hear from you. And also don't forget to check out our website, wfwcdivorce.com, for some additional resources, tips, and tools. Until next time, let's keep the divorce conversation moving forward.